This is Ozarks at Large for Wednesday afternoon, February 3rd, 2021. Thanks for spending time with us. This is 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. On our show today, an effort to repeal the officially recognized Confederate Flag Day in Arkansas, a commemoration observed by some since the late 1950s. And we go back to the 1920s to understand how the modern Arkansas Razorback mascot came to be. Turns out it was an Oklahoma native who got the ball rolling. We start a new series dedicated to the first 150 years of students, faculty, and events at the University of Arkansas. The 150th anniversary of the founding of the university is next month. And for the next year, there are special events scheduled to celebrate that anniversary and, next year, the 150th anniversary of the first day of classes. After Ozarks on Here and Now, Miguel Cardona faces questions from the Senate looking to confirm him as the next Secretary of Education. One key question, when does he think students will be back in the classroom? Also, Here and Now political strategists join the show to grade President Biden's efforts to pass a new COVID-19 relief package. And more of the latest news on Here and Now, beginning at 1. 44 more Arkansans have died from COVID-19 after yesterday's reporting from the Arkansas Department of Health. More than 4,900 fatalities from the virus have been recorded in the state. Other numbers from yesterday indicate at least a temporary slowing of the infection. There were 1,510 new cases in the most recent testing period. Hospitalizations continue to be at a two-month low, with a net decrease of 20 during the past 24 hours. Active cases dropped by more than 300 people. There are now 16,331 active cases in the state. We'll hear what Governor Asa Hutchinson and other state officials had to say about vaccinations, virus variants, and more at yesterday's press briefing in just a few minutes on today's show. A Stand Your Ground bill in the Arkansas legislature is stalled for the time being. The bill would end the duty to retreat when using physical or deadly force if the person using the force is lawfully present, has reason to believe they were being threatened, and not engaged in criminal activity, and if the person is not a felon or is the initial aggressor. The bill failed to move out of the House Judiciary Committee yesterday. Still, the bill's sponsors say they plan to use a parliamentary maneuver to allow the full House to vote to extract the bill from committee, then have a full vote in the chamber. The vote in yesterday's committee hearing came after 3 hours of debate and more than two dozen witnesses speaking against the proposal. One Arkansan is among the finalists to create new statues to stand in the U.S. Capitol. The statues of native Arkansans Daisy Bates and Johnny Cash will replace current statues of Uriah Rose and James P. Clark, currently in the Capitol. Kevin Kreese of Little Rock is one of three finalists for the Johnny Cash statue. Mock-ups of the statues are due from the artists in early June. The next concert in the University of Arkansas Music Faculty Series Accent is scheduled for tomorrow evening at 7:30. Alan Gossman, a pianist and music theorist, is planning to perform Bach, Mozart, and Brahms. He'll be on the Stella Boyle Smith Concert Hall stage. The audience will be wherever they want to be. The concert is being presented on the UARC Music YouTube channel. Other already recorded performances from the series can be found there as well. Make it four straight SEC wins for the Arkansas Razorback men's basketball team. Arkansas defeated Mississippi State 62-45 last night in Fayetteville to improve to 14-5 overall, 6-4 in the conference. Next, Texas A&M Saturday evening. Increasing cloudiness tonight, lows around 47. Tomorrow, 30% chance of showers, temperatures falling during the afternoon. Windy tomorrow as well, with gusts from the northwest up to 35 miles per hour. Thursday night, clear, lows in the mid to upper 20s. And the early weekend forecast includes a slight chance of afternoon showers Saturday, with highs from the upper 40s to lower 50s. Mostly sunny Sunday, with highs from 37 to 44. This is Ozarks at Large. The infection rate of COVID-19 continues to slow more than 30 days into the new year. Hospitalizations are at a two-month low in Arkansas. Active cases have now dropped below 16,500 for the first time since early December. Still, Arkansas's Secretary of Health, Dr. Jose Romero, cautions that the encouraging numbers should not be used as an excuse to let one's guard down.
even though we are making improvements, it's not a time to back off on the three things that we think are the most important for physical mitigation of infection. And that's wearing the mask, washing our hands, and keeping distance.
Dr. Romero also warns that national experts expect variants of the virus to become the dominant strain soon, and that could mean another surge of coronavirus cases. Dr. Romero made his comments yesterday during the weekly press briefing regarding COVID-19 in Arkansas, featuring Governor Asa Hutchinson and other state officials. The governor says the state has used nearly 62% of the vaccine doses in the state program for health care and long-term care facilities. He says work continues to be done to get more shots to Arkansans qualifying for vaccinations at this time.
People ask me, well, where's the other 39% of the doses? Well, some are reserved for second doses that will be given out. That takes a little bit longer to get those scheduled. And we continue to work to increase that percentage. The whole team at the Department of Health and Colonel Ader is working very hard on that, and our pharmacy and our hospital partners as well.
The governor says the state has virtually finished the first round of shots at long-term care facilities. And the governor says he learned yesterday during a phone call with the director of President Biden's coronavirus task force that Arkansas will receive a 5% boost in vaccines beginning this week. That's on top of a 16% increase received last week. And the governor says Walmart, as a preferred federal supplier, will receive more doses later this month.
To be distributed and available in over 60 stores across Arkansas. This is the beginning of that process. I want to caution everyone that they will start receiving them most likely on February 11th. So it's that week time frame that they will begin the process of getting those doses out. And again, this is over and above our state allocation.
The governor says the state is not yet ready to move beyond the vaccinations included in the earliest 1B category. That includes teachers and people age 70 and older. He says he will allow a curfew placed on bars and restaurants in December to expire at the end of the day today. Businesses serving alcohol for on-premise consumption have had to close by 11 p.m. since before the holidays. Dr. Ivy Pfeffer with the Arkansas Department of Education says nearly three-fourths of schools in Arkansas and more than half of school districts have not had to have significant changes in learning situations during the first 100 days of the 2020-21 school year. Mike Preston, the state secretary of commerce, says Arkansas's Pandemic Unemployment Assistance Office reopened Friday after undergoing updates with more than 40 changes, some of those designed to help catch potential fraud earlier.
The good news is on that first weekend, we sent over 4,900 payments. Additionally, last night we had 9,800 payments. So we're up to a little over 14,700 Arkansans in the PUA system that have been paid for these first couple of days. We anticipate more going out today and over the course of the next several days. We have sent 60,000 emails to those eligible and are continuing to file weekly claims. What is very important, if you're one of those 60,000 that you have received the email, to click on the link within the email to upload your ID and your additional documentations.
The governor also highlighted the state revenue report yesterday that places Arkansas 7 months into a fiscal year, about $400 million of surplus beyond what was forecast. He says in light of what he calls a recovering economy, he wants elected officials in Washington to work on a relief package that he thinks is appropriate.
I would urge the White House and Congress to compromise as they consider the COVID relief package that begins at $1.9 trillion. And that's because the economy is expected to grow this year at over 3.5%. And we're going to recover from the slowdown in the economy because of COVID without that necessary massive infusion of money. If we go big, then we go big into debt for our nation and for the next generation. And my encouragement is not just go big, but go reasonable. And I think our economy in Arkansas and the surplus that I've indicated demonstrate that that's a reasonable course for Congress and the White House to consider.
The complete press briefing, including more details about the pandemic unemployment assistance protocols, can be viewed at Governor Hutchinson's YouTube channel. This week, a Democrat-led House panel launched a probe into coronavirus outbreaks at meatpacking plants around the country. Monday, Representative James Clyburn of South Carolina, who chairs the House Select Subcommittee on the Coronavirus Crisis, sent letters to Tyson Foods, Smithfield Foods, and JBS USA requesting information on the number of sick employees, facility closures, safety measures, and leave policies for when workers tested positive. Magali Licoli, who is the executive director of Inseremos, a local workers' justice organization, says she welcomes the investigation.
It really feels a relief that finally an administration is taking seriously what we've been saying for almost a year now. So I am glad that now they are taking the necessary steps to protect workers and to investigate and to hold these companies accountable for what they've done to these workers.
But Licoli says it's still too late for thousands of workers. According to the Food and Environment Reporting Network, which has been mapping COVID-19 outbreaks in the U.S. food system, nearly 54,000 workers at 570 meatpacking plants have tested positive for coronavirus. At least 270 have died. In his letter to Tyson, Representative Clyburn writes that the company doesn't appear to have taken basic precautions to prevent outbreaks at its meat packing facilities, where nearly 12,500 workers contracted the virus and nearly 40 have died. He also cites an instance where Tyson managers at a plant in Iowa ordered workers to remain on the job and place bets on how many of them would end up getting COVID-19. Licoli believes the investigation will find that Tyson Foods and other companies valued production over the lives of their employees.
One of the things that we've been fighting and we've been asking the companies to do ever since we saw the outbreaks happening at the poultry plants in Arkansas was that they needed to contact tracing workers. That was crucial to stop the spread of the virus and to put workers in quarantine to make sure that they were not also going to spread the virus to other not infected workers. And so that was precisely what the company really refused to do, because if they were going to do that, they will be forced to shut down the plants.
Statistics show that two-thirds of employees at meatpacking plants across the country are Black or Hispanic, and many live in low-income families. Now, almost a year into the pandemic, Licoli says poultry companies have normalized COVID-19 in the workplace, but she says she's hopeful the Occupational Safety and Health Administration will be better about enforcing worker safety laws now that the agency is also under investigation.
Hopefully that right now it will become normal, you know, at least to file a complaint that workers have the security that these agencies are looking into for them, not against them, as it felt last year. Last year, it felt like everything was going against them, the companies, the government, nobody was acting to protect these workers. So hopefully now with this new administration and the new measurements that they're taking, finally these workers could breathe a little bit.
According to Representative Clyburn, under the Trump administration, OSHA issued only 8 citations and fewer than $80,000 in penalties for coronavirus-related violations at meatpacking companies. In a statement, Tyson representatives say the company's top priority will always be the health and safety of their people, and they look forward to working with the congressional committee to share what they've done and continue to do to protect team members from coronavirus. According to the statement, Tyson invested more than $500 million during the pandemic to transform its facilities with protective measures like walk-through temperature scanners and social distance monitors. The company says it also hired a chief medical officer and has been testing thousands of workers a week to locate any instances of the virus. This is Ozarks at Large. This morning, the House Committee on State Agencies and Governmental Affairs considered a bill that would allow Marshallese migrants who are not citizens to become police officers. Although the bill's lead sponsor, Representative Megan Godfrey, said the intent of the legislation is narrowly tailored to apply to Marshallese migrants, a few committee members voiced concerns one section of the bill could be interpreted in such a way that it would open eligibility to other non-citizens. Representative Godfrey pulled the bill down to amend that section before bringing it back to committee. Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda has more.
Representative Megan Godfrey filed House Bill 1342, also known as the Marshallese Law Enforcement Act, last week. The legislation aims to amend state law to allow non-immigrants legally admitted to the United States under a compact of free association to apply for positions as police officers. Currently, the law requires applicants to be U.S. citizens.
We just found a really good common sense solution to a problem that exists, in that Marshallese who are here legally but are not citizens cannot serve as law enforcement. And so this just expands the eligibility in the law to allow them to serve their communities.
Representative Godfrey is a Democratic legislator from Springdale, which has a large Marshallese population. While drafting this legislation, Godfrey collaborated with the Consul General for the Springdale Consulate of the Republic of the Marshall Islands, as well as Northwest Arkansas law enforcement agencies. If approved, Representative Godfrey says the bill could increase diversity in law enforcement agencies, which may help build trust between police departments and communities of color.
I think we've seen, especially this year, just how important it is to have law enforcement that have good, strong relationships with the communities they serve. And this is an opportunity to promote community safety and trust, to, you know, prove that representation matters and to expand a police force, not only in number, but also in diversity, and to allow those who protect and serve their communities to look more like them and to be more connected culturally and linguistically.
HB 1342 is based on similar legislation passed in 2017 in Oregon, which is home to a large population of Pacific Islanders. The bill, which permits COFA migrants legally admitted to the country to become police officers, went into effect January 1st, 2018. Eldon Alec used to live in Oregon, so he was familiar with the law when he moved to Northwest Arkansas to take over as Consul General of the Springdale Consulate in 2017.
So when I came here, I saw that it's quite a large population of Marshallese here. And there were already a couple of Marshallese that were in the police force in Springdale. But there were also a couple of Marshallese that were working with Washington County, but as contractors, they were not allowed to carry guns. So they came to me and asked me that they've been trying to apply, but they've always end right there when it's asked for their citizenship. So I said, if that can't happen in Oregon, why not here?
Alec estimates there are 15,000 to 20,000 Marshallese residents in Northwest Arkansas alone, but there are other Marshallese communities located throughout the state, so the legislation could have an impact on more than just one region. Alec says he's been working with Representative Godfrey for about 2 years on the legislation, which he calls a win-win situation for everybody that will promote peace and trust.
I think it will lessen crimes, for sure. A lot of Marshallese, they come over here and they don't really understand the laws here. And it's a challenge, and I know that. From working with the other Marshallese that are already in the police force, they said they every time they sub-Marshallese or they see them the side of the road and they talk to them, they're always explaining to them what the laws are, what they can and can't do. So this will also help educate the Marshallese on all the laws.
For those who may oppose the legislation, Alec points to Marshall Islanders' history with the military. Eligible Marshallese citizens may serve in the U.S. military, and according to the State Department, they do, volunteering at per capita rates higher than many states.
I would tell them, if we can defend this country, why can't we defend the town?
The bill has received bipartisan support, with Republican Representative Keith Slape listed as the sole co-sponsor when the bill was filed January 28th. Since then, Representative Megan Godfrey says more Republican colleagues have reached out asking to be added as co-sponsors. The bill now lists 11 co-sponsors, all Republicans, in the House, and Republican David Wallace is the primary sponsor in the Senate. You can read the full text of the bill and track its progress through the legislature at arkleg.state.ar.us. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And we're going to hear more about the legislature later on this edition of Ozarks, including comments related to a proposal to penalize Arkansas schools using the 1619 Project to teach United States history. And on tomorrow's Ozarks, the latest round of economic impact payments for Arkansans. That story and much more on a Thursday edition of Ozarks at Large tomorrow at noon and 7 p.m. on 91.3 KUAF, your public radio station for more than 35 years.
Support comes from Butterfield Trail Village, Northwest Arkansas's retirement community catering to active lifestyles and resident well-being, offering a variety of activities, living options, plus outdoor spaces, including access to city trails. ButterfieldTrailVillage.org for more. Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art presents the second season of North Forest Lights, an enchanted nighttime forest experience featuring magical light and sound installations. Advanced ticket reservations recommended. More information at crystalbridges.org.
Good Wednesday. This is Ozarks at Large. You can listen to Ozarks at Large when you'd like. If you subscribe to our free podcast versions of the daily editions of our show, you can subscribe through any of the major podcast distributors. And if you'd like to hear the most recent edition of Ozarks at Large, just ask your smart speaker to please play Ozarks at Large. The Saturday preceding Easter Sunday has been celebrated as Confederate Flag Day in Arkansas since 1957. As Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports, a bipartisan state legislative measure aims to repeal it.
Democrat State Representative Andrew Collins, District 35, Pulaski County, says he's filed House Bill 1203 to repeal Confederate Flag Day in Arkansas because it's time.
I was surprised, as I think many people were, that Confederate Flag Day existed in Arkansas when I discovered it this past year. It was actually established in 1957, which is the same year as the integration of Central High School. And it has remained on the books. It was originally made a crime to use the flag for any purpose other than to honor the Confederate States of America. They did remove the crime. But I think it's time that we recognize that for so many people in our state, the flag is hurtful and offensive in its symbols.
The red Confederate flag with a blue cross embedded with 13 white stars was never adopted by the Confederate States of America, but was flown in battle during the Civil War, which spanned 1861 to 1865. Joey McCutcheon is a trial lawyer in Fort Smith. He represents the legal interests of Confederate heritage groups, including the Sons of the Southern Cross, Sons of Confederate Veterans, and United Daughters of the Confederacy. He has family roots in the Confederacy.
My great-great-grandfather, John C. Wright McCutcheon, was a Confederate veteran with the Alabama 5th. Obviously, we're influenced by our heritage and how we grew up and those types of things. So over the years, I've just taken an interest in my heritage.
McCutcheon says it's important to not erase Confederate history.
But we've got to preserve history. You know, otherwise we will have no history. Confederate Flag Day for the folks I talk to is simply to honor our Confederate veterans, which, as you know or may not know, are United States veterans now by act of Congress. So it's a very important day, and it's a sacred day for us.
The Confederate flag, McCutcheon says, has no historic association with white nationalism or racism.
Yeah, this flag, the Confederate flag, has been hijacked by hate groups.
Which is precisely what spurred Representative Collins in part to file his bill to repeal Confederate Flag Day after seeing it brazenly carried through the U.S. Capitol during the domestic terror attack on January 6th by white nationalists.
I think it was extraordinary that the flag flew in the Capitol when it had never flown in that Capitol, even during the Civil War, I believe. And I think a lot of people had a visceral reaction to that because, of course, the Confederacy was separatist and rebelled and fought a bloody civil war against the United States. And I think those of us who are Americans and are proud Americans want to defend our country and stand under its flag rather than the flag of a separatist group. I certainly do. And I also, for me, the flag symbolizes racism and an ideology that is offensive to me personally.
The bill to repeal Confederate Flag Day in Arkansas, co-sponsored by State Senator Breanne Davis, Republican District 16, is scheduled for consideration in the House Committee on State Agencies and Governmental Affairs. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
And thanks for spending time with us on this Wednesday on Ozarks at Large. Native American students preparing for the ACT can take advantage of the Cherokee Nation's free virtual ACT prep course next month. The deadline for the camp is February 26th. The camp itself takes place on March 27th. More information, including registration information, can be found at CherokeeNationFoundation.org. The Fort Smith Regional Art Museum will host a virtual lecture about the art of Marjorie Williams Smith tomorrow night. RAM Assistant Curator Samantha Rhodes will deliver the lecture on Zoom at 7 tomorrow evening. The event is free and will explore the techniques the artist used to create her intricate floral works, a process known as silver point that dates back to medieval scribes. You can find out more at the Facebook page for Fort Smith Regional Art Museum. The University of Arkansas is celebrating 150 years this year and next. The 150th anniversary of the founding of the university is next month, and then next year will be the 150th anniversary of the first day of classes. There will be a kickoff event in September, Come As You Arkansas, an all-day event open to the public that will take place in a progressive style in several different buildings and outdoor spaces. The pandemic means many of the first observations are virtual, and there are details at 150.uark.edu. That's the number, 150.uark.edu. We get into the celebration today with the first installment of a new series highlighting many of the students, faculty, events, and research in the University of Arkansas's history. Charlie Allison, the executive editor at University Relations at the U of A, takes us back to the modern formation of that very familiar symbol, the mascot Razorback.
A couple of decades into the 20th century, 1921 or so, a student from the Choctaw Nation came to the university, hoping to learn how to be a teacher or a coach. Doy Hancock, better known as Hank, loved football and other sports while growing up, but during high school he suffered an injury that prevented him from continuing his competition. Instead, he started drawing caricatures of his fellow high school teammates, and by the time he got to the U of A, he'd become quite proficient, and not a little swell-headed about it. Moving into his dormitory, he complained about the drawing of the university mascot at the time. It was not a Razorback you would recognize today, and in defense of Hancock, it was not that exciting a drawing either. It was a silhouette relatively true to what feral pigs of Arkansas looked like at the time. It was lean and long-legged, more like a rangy dog, and completely lacking in personality. And Hank said so. Upon hearing Hancock's disparaging remarks, though, some upperclassmen in his dormitory took offense. They told Hank they wouldn't permit him in his bed until he drew something better. Why does that sound so 1920s? Well, Hank jotted off a standing Razorback that passed muster, and the seniors let him sleep. Maybe it wasn't a sound sleep, though, because that incident planted a first seed in his head. Then a second seed came during his sophomore year. Hank helped create an enormously long banner across the south end of the football field for the university's first homecoming game in 1922. Back then, the football field was about where the Fine Arts Center and Gibson Hall are today. Their banner read simply, "Arkansas never quits." Okay, not the most original idea, but on that day, the Razorbacks needed that poster. They played a highly rated and heavily favored team from Southern Methodist University. The Razorbacks never let up, though, playing inspired defense and then winning on a touchdown throw to Homer Berry from Bill Fulbright. Wait, the Bill Fulbright? Yes, yes, that Bill Fulbright. Jay William, the future Rhodes Scholar, law professor and president of the university, the U.S. Senator known for his progressive work in creating a world-renowned international exchange program and opposing the war in Vietnam. But also, the senator rightly criticized for his callous decisions to sign the Southern Manifesto and vote against civil rights and the Fair Housing Act of the 1960s. That guy, one and the same. But that's a story for another episode. Let's get back to the story about Doy Hancock for a minute. The homecoming victory inspired Hank to reimagine the Razorback mascot. Soon on, he drew his first running Razorback. It was a wild-eyed, slobbering beast with fury and fight in its cloven hooves. No standing around. Hancock drew the Razorback full speed ahead. You could feel it leaping off the page. That proved to be the first iteration of the running Razorback, but it would not be the last. The symbol morphed every few years over the last decade into the iconic logo seen today on helmets and jerseys and every tchotchke imaginable across Arkansas and the nation. Hancock graduated in 1926 with a Bachelor of Science in Education, having been the first Native American to serve as editor of the Razorback Yearbook. He also helped create the university's first humor magazine, The White Mule, and Hank was also president of the Arkansas Booster Club, the Cadet Club, and the Bohemian Art Club. That last one's the one I want to join. After graduation, Hank worked as an illustrator for most of his life, except for a 13-year stint in the U.S. Army. But he'll be remembered for his rendition of the Razorback, easily recognized wherever you go across Arkansas, the nation, and around the world. Many years ago, I took a trip to Edinburgh, Scotland. On my first morning there, still a little groggy from jet lag, I went for a run around the downtown. It's a good way to get your bearings in a new place. Running east along Prince's Street, the main boulevard, I noticed a runner about a quarter mile away coming toward me. Even at that distance, though, I could see the runner was wearing a shirt with a Razorback. We reached an intersection with a stoplight at the same time. I waited at my corner, and when she ran across, I asked her, "Aren't you Lily Kleinman?" She was thrilled that somebody recognized her, much less in Scotland, but not the least bit surprised. No matter where she had traveled, whenever she wore a Razorback shirt, someone would step out of the crowd and ask about Arkansas. Lily was a multiple All-American distance runner for Arkansas, and I had seen her win the 3,000-meter run and the cross-country championships. I asked her what she was doing in Edinburgh. She'd returned home to Germany since finishing college, but she was doing some traveling and thinking about professional bicycling rather than running. She asked what I was doing there, and I said I was planning to run the Edinburgh Marathon and just hoping to stay ahead of the Loch Ness Monster. But that's another story for another day. For today, just remember Hank Hancock and his iconic drawing of the running Razorback.
Charlie Allison is Executive Editor, University Relations at the University of Arkansas. His Hill Talk segments focusing on 150 years of University of Arkansas history will be featured through the next several months on Ozarks at Large. Ozarks at Large hasn't been around for 150 years, but more than 30. And in about 90 seconds, we'll go back to 1996 to hear a story from Jennifer Fulford about the work to preserve Native American languages. The time machine ahead on this Ozarks at Large.
For the Central Arkansas Library System, I'm Mark Chris with an Encyclopedia of Arkansas Minute. Though he's largely forgotten today, African-American poet George Poole Ballard is a noteworthy figure in Arkansas's literary history. Born in 1882, Ballard was working minor jobs in Fayetteville when he began publishing poems in the Daily Democrat, edited by Lessie Stringfellow Reed. His 1924 poem Woodrow Wilson, A Tribute, was reprinted in several newspapers, bringing him national attention. Though Reed saw no serious literary worth in Ballard's poetry, she oversaw publication of Ozark Ballads, a collection of his poems printed to help pay his mortgage. Ballard's poems showed effective use of rhyme schemes, meter, verse forms, and other devices, and some offered commentary on racial issues. In 1936, the library of Fayetteville's new Lincoln School for Black Students was dedicated as the George Ballard Library, and he often attended meetings of the University City Poetry Club. He died on December 3, 1951, and lies in an unmarked grave in Oak Cemetery. To learn more, visit encyclopediaofarkansas.net.
Okay, let's turn the clock back 25 years. It was this week in 1996 that Ozarks at Large presented a story from Jennifer Fulford about a local business working to preserve Native American languages. Here's Jennifer's report from Friday night, February 9th, 1996.
At the very least, VIP Publishing intends to record the native languages of the five civilized tribes based in Oklahoma. Like most of the tribes in the United States, the Cherokee, Choctaw, Chickasaw, Seminole, and Muscogee tribes have distinct languages that date back hundreds of years. But over recent decades, many issues have overshadowed the need for tribal language preservation. VIP Publishing co-owner Rick Ebby says that makes his job quite formidable, but very important.
The tribes have so many things to deal with on basic survival and health and education that they haven't been able to really work on the language very much.
Ebby and a partner produce educational audios and books of Native American languages. The first product they made available through VIP Publishing was a set of audio tapes and a 50-page workbook and glossary called Introduction to Cherokee. First produced in 1989, Introduction to Cherokee provides instruction to learn the basics of the language.
Osiyo, Tohijan. You have heard that time after time, if not you will. Osiyo, Tohijan. Hello, how are you? And the answer would be from the other person. Osiyo. Osiyo. Meaning, I am fine.
VIP now offers more than 100 items of instructional language audios, videos, books, and music. Rick Ebby.
Well, we have now in our catalog Cherokee and Choctaw, Chickasaw, Kiowa, Lakota, and Potawatomi. And those are these. Now, the Lakota and Potawatomi are stuff that we didn't produce ourselves. I found these people, and now we just buy the tapes from them and put them in our catalog. So it's grown since 89 when we started.
Ebby says he didn't realize 6 years ago when he first began the project part-time that a general need existed among Native Americans to preserve their languages. Not a Native American himself, he has learned much about Native American history and tribes through his now full-time job.
There's over 500 recognized Indian nations in this country now. Some of them, the language is extinct. I think the last speaker of Quapaw, which is originally Arkansas tribe, I think the last fluent speaker died a couple of years ago. So the Quapaw may never be regained or may never be a language. And
VIP Publishing uses speakers on its tapes whose first language is their tribes. Ebby says the company's efforts have been received well by the tribes approached for assistance in finding speakers. He says most recognize the need for the instructional materials. Some resources have been designed with schools in mind.
The need for the instruction is more for the younger generations. The older people speak it, and there's some people that I talk to that say their grandparents don't even speak English. There are still people who only speak Cherokee. But that's getting less and less, and as the older generation is dying off, then the younger generation is not learning it. Generations are not learning it as much.
The generational decline in the languages dates back to the 1880s, when the U.S. government initiated programs to suppress the culture and traditions of Indian tribes and cease the speaking or teaching of Indian languages in government schools. Charlie Jones, the historian of the Choctaw Nation of Oklahoma based in Durant, says this policy marks the beginning of the decline.
Because of this education policy, you know, we were severely punished if we spoke the language, and as a result, I didn't teach my kid and all the other parents we just didn't teach our kids, so it's disappearing now. You go to Indian home up in the mountain, everyone, all the little kids are speaking English.
However, recent legislation in Oklahoma has changed that.
House Bill 1017, in that bill it said that the North American Indian language are to be introduced into schools so the students could have a choice of French, German, Spanish, or Indian. This is a foreign language. So, but the tribe had to be willing to work at it. So we got a committee of about six or seven Choctaw-speaking person and working with the Oklahoma State Curriculum Superintendent too. And we've got ours ready.
I love you. Chee. Hullo le. Chee. Hullo le.
Jones, the native speaker on this instructional tape for the Choctaw Nation, is working with VIP Publishing to use the materials in Oklahoma schools. The Choctaw Nation of Oklahoma and VIP Publishing have begun developing intermediate materials for advanced learners in upper grades. Rick Ebby says he wants to finish such materials for the five civilized tribes. His dream would be to send out a team of recording engineers across the country to collect the native languages still alive.
Every year there are languages dying. You know, it's not, that doesn't stop just because we don't have the resources to go find them and preserve that stuff. So that's the biggest thing I would say that that I feel like we can't really accomplish all of the preservation that that I feel needs to be done. But there are, you know, through networking and finding out other people, there are more and more people doing this.
For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jennifer Fulford.
Amazing Grace in the Choctaw language, Choctaw hymn number 48, Prayer to the Holy Spirit. Shalom bish holy topama ishminti polacha hata kelba shapiyaham ishpi yukpalashki pichon kashno siya tokma at ish ok chalashki ish pin yok bi ichik banu ichim ayah nishki.
Jennifer Fulford's story first aired on the Friday night, February 9th, 1996 edition of Ozarks at Large. Our ability to dive into 31 years of Ozarks at Large archives made possible with support from the University of Arkansas Women's Giving Circle and with efforts of Ozarks at Large's Timothy Dennis. This is Ozarks at Large. Professional cross-country mountain bike racing is coming to Fayetteville this spring. The Oz Trails U.S. Pro Cup will be held over the course of two weekends in April at the city's newly opened Centennial Park at Millsap Mountain. Molly Ron, the CEO of Experience Fayetteville, which is helping host the event, says some of the women and men who will be racing the course will be vying to qualify for the Summer Olympics, scheduled to be held in Tokyo later this year.
What I want people to understand about it is this is a destination for events. Centennial Park was built purposefully with this caliber of event in mind. The course is designed to be able to host events of this type.
For those unfamiliar with professional mountain biking, Ron likens the event to an NCAA tournament. The Pro Cup is going to be held the weekends of April 9th and 16th. That's when professional and amateur riders will take on the purpose-built race course that includes obstacles like rocks, punchy climbs, and flowing descents meant to test riders' abilities and stamina. And since it's just under 2.5 miles long, Molly Ron says the course is meant to be spectator-friendly.
So a lot of people in Fayetteville are familiar with another wonderful professional cycling event that has gone on in town for years. And of course, I'm talking about the Joe Martin Stage Race. This is much different in terms of the spectator experience. So not to take anything away from that race, which is also fun to watch, the cross-country mountain biking that's going to happen with the Oz Trails US Pro Cup, you can go and stay in one spot and get to see more of the overall course in a way that you can't in a stage race.
And since the event is taking place during a global pandemic, Ron says they are working on striking a balance between inviting spectators to cheer on the racers and COVID-19 safety protocols.
We are currently in the process of working with the Arkansas Department of Health and the city of Fayetteville to determine, capacity, how we will maintain that capacity, and how we will work to keep spectators and athletes safe. Masks will absolutely be required, and the mask mandate will, of course, be enforced. And beyond that, we're hashing out those details right now. So we'll have more information to share closer to the event time.
And Molly Ron says this is just the first of many large-scale cycling events that will be held at Centennial Park. About a year from now, Millsap Mountain will host the UCI Cyclocross World Championships, another spectator-friendly cycling discipline.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten, in part, by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. Theater Squared presents Schoolgirls, or the African Mean Girls Play. This comedy features Paulina, the reigning queen bee at Ghana's most exclusive boarding school, Erica, a new student with undeniable talent and beauty, and the Miss Global Universe pageant. On stage through February 14th, 877-7477 or theater2.org for tickets and information.
This is Ozarks at Large. The team at Talk Business and Politics continues to cover the Arkansas legislature with daily updates and conversations with lawmakers at talkbusiness.net. Recently, Roby Brock solicited thoughts from two sides of a bill that would penalize schools in Arkansas using the Pulitzer Prize-winning 1619 Project as inspiration for teaching United States history. The 1619 Project is a New York Times-affiliated work that examines how the launch of slavery in North America more than 400 years ago informed policies and life of the continent and United States for centuries. We'll hear the comments of State Representative Mark Lowry, a Republican from Maumelle, and then from State Representative Joyce Elliott, a Democrat from Little Rock.
Well, what I'm doing is protecting students who don't feel like they have a voice and parents who don't feel like they have a voice. And also some of the feedback I've gotten, teachers who don't feel like they have a voice to be able to say that this is an inaccurate way to talk about the history of 1619 when the first African slave showed up on this continent. But the offshoot of it or the after effect of it is that students then, the writer says that all of American history is based on white oppression. Well, it doesn't take much to look around the room and to identify in an uncomfortable way, in a almost child abuse way, which students are the oppressors.
That purpose is rather to explore voices, every voice. And in some of those, there are going to be voices students haven't heard before. There are going to be voices that are going to make students uncomfortable. But isn't that what the world is? The idea is to teach our students to deal with being uncomfortable, if that is a part of learning, and it most certainly is. Show me somebody, unless it was Einstein probably, who's not been uncomfortable in a math class. That's not the reason not to take the class. And so I think there's an assumption built in that if we're talking about the 1619 Project, somehow that is going to negate the voices of white students. That is just a 180 from what would happen in any good classroom, because every voice matters in exploring those perspectives. Otherwise, you're not teaching. You're just feeding kids information.
Joyce Elliott is a Democrat in the Arkansas House of Representatives representing Little Rock. Before her, we heard from Mark Lowry, a Republican representative from Maumelle. Lowry is the author of the bill seeking to limit Arkansas schools from using the 1619 Project as a tool in helping teach United States history. He is also the author of another bill that would restrict how teachers can address issues of social justice in the classroom. They each made their comments to Roby Brock with our partner Talk Business and Politics after the Legislative Black Caucus invited Representative Lowry to speak to them about the bills. Roby and the Talk Business and Politics team update legislative coverage every day at talkbusiness.net.
It's the Community Spotlight on KUAF. I'm Pete Hartman. Today, over the phone in the Nancy Blair Operations Studio, we're speaking with Danielle DeLille. Danielle, nice to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you too, sir.
We're talking to you about the Taneytown Farmers Market. Of course, like many markets, opening up that May 1st date. Been around for a while, but y'all are really looking to grow, right?
That's correct. We've been around since 2017. This year, the market is looking to expand exponentially, and we're needing more farmers, more produce vendors to join our market.
There are some stipulations on what kind of farmers who can take part in the Taneytown Farmers Market, correct?
We have to abide by the Arkansas cottage laws. Those can be found on the Department of Health website. Produce vendors, jellies, jams, anything homemade in that is made within Washington, Benton, or Madison County.
So many, you know, farmers markets over the past decade especially really spring up. But it what I like also is the collaboration between the different towns' markets and themselves. Have you seen that as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I actually have it's my eyes have been open to that since I took over role of director. I didn't know that all of the managers for the markets in the area meet together. Right now it's virtually, but we all meet together and bounce ideas off of each other and share things with each other to help each other's markets.
Danielle DeLille with the Taneytown Farmers Market, again, opening May 1st, and they are looking to expand their vendors for this market. Danielle, if someone wants to know more, maybe even how they could help you guys out, what's the best way to find the information?
We are online at the city of Taneytown. Click under the city park. You'll see a link for our market. It tells all about us. There's an email address on there, contact information. There's an application. Any of the cottage laws that that we have to abide by are on there as well. Or if you have any questions, you could just give me a call, 870-321-4956, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Danielle DeLille with the Taneytown Farmers Market. And I hope it's a great, very successful market, and hopefully we can have more than a few people out there each Saturday.
I hope so. That's our goal. Our goal is to be your one-stop shop for Saturday morning.
Danielle, thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Peter. I appreciate you.
And before we leave you this Wednesday on Ozarks at Large, couple of updates. You may recall that in January, there was a conversation on our program with two of the authors of Trees, Shrubs, and Woody Vines of Arkansas. It's a new book that is being published by the University of Arkansas Press. It was created through the support of the Ozark Society. Well, Trees, Shrubs, and Woody Vines of Arkansas has just hit number one in the nation on the Amazon Hot New Releases listings for new releases in botany. You can hear the conversation. Just search at ozarksatlarge.com. Congratulations. And if you are a fan of Razorback football games taking place in War Memorial Stadium in Little Rock, good news, that's going to continue for a while. This morning, the University of Arkansas Athletic Department announced some amended scheduling that keeps games in War Memorial for the years 2021, 2023, 2024, and 2025, though it moves some games to Fayetteville. I'll explain. In 2021, the University of Arkansas Pine Bluff will take on the Razorbacks in Little Rock on October 23rd. Now, the SEC game with Missouri will take place in Fayetteville on November 27th. In 2023, Western Carolina will be at Arkansas on September 2nd. Missouri will again be in Arkansas at Reynolds Razorback Stadium on November 25th of that year. In 2024, Arkansas Pine Bluff, again against the Razorbacks in Little Rock on August 31st. And now UAB will move to Arkansas, well, to Fayetteville, for the September 14th, 2024 game. And then finally, in 2025, I know it sounds like a long ways away, but guess what? Arkansas State and the University of Arkansas will finally meet on the gridiron, that game taking place at War Memorial Stadium in Little Rock on September 6th, 2025. This is 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Rogers, and Siloam Springs. 91.3 KUAF is a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. Contributors to this Wednesday edition of our show included Antoinette Grajeda, Jacqueline Froelich, and Zuzanna Sitek, who delivered information and sound about Tyson Foods and meatpacking plants, as well as the upcoming UCI event in Fayetteville. Timothy Dennis produced our show. He also did archaeology to find our archive segment on Native American languages. He found some other pieces from previous February shows that we'll share throughout the rest of this month. Oh, and by the way, that archive segment produced by Jennifer Fulford. Thanks to Charlie Allison from the University of Arkansas for getting our observance of the University of Arkansas's sesquicentennial started. Thank you, Charlie. We'll hear more from him as 2021 rolls on. Our thanks to the team at Talk Business and Politics for their partnership and coverage of the legislative session. The Community Spotlight is produced by Pete Hartman inside the Nancy Blair Operations Studio at the Carver Center for Public Radio. Support for archive material on Ozarks at Large provided by the University of Arkansas Women's Giving Circle. And our theme is written and produced by Daryl Sean. You can find Daryl often performing live and taking requests at his Facebook and Instagram feeds. Wow! A lot of people working to make sure this show comes together, including you. Thank you for your attention and your continued support. From the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio, I'm Kyle Kellums. We will be back with you tomorrow at noon and 7. Be well, get rest, enjoy the rest of this Wednesday as you can.